Good day. Today is Wednesday, 15th July 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, I'm going to briefly start by discussing the situation in the Middle East, where the Iranian government has now formally said that it no longer considers itself bound by the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding. And it does look as if we are in effect back in a situation of all-out war. Well, at least maybe not all-out war, but anyway, war between Iran and the United States. There's missiles and drones being launched by each side against the other. There's a very good analysis of the overall situation by Larry Johnson on Sonar 21, his indispensable Substack site. The critical, the most important fact to understand from all of this, however, is that the Strait of Hormuz is now indeed definitely closed to traffic, and there is no shipping passing through the Strait of Hormuz. Two tankers were attacked by Iranian missiles trying to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, and both of them were severely damaged. And tragically, on one of these tankers, a seaman was killed, Indian by nationality, apparently. There's also been Iranian strikes against tankers that have been trying to offload oil from an Emirati port, which is not, which is beyond the Strait of Hormuz. And of course, as I discussed extensively in my program yesterday, there are now growing concerns and issues and discussions about what moves the Houthis might take to shut down the Gate of Tears, the access point to the Red Sea. So we have a renewed crisis in the Middle East, and the price of oil is rising. And I will anticipate by saying that nothing that I have seen up to now suggests to me that the United States possesses the capability to knock out Iran or to force open by military means the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump has recently taken to talking about a ground operation, but not, interestingly, by American troops. Unclear who he thinks would be prepared to carry out a ground operation, essentially on the US's behalf. And, of course, the fact that we are back in this situation again changes everything geopolitically. A few weeks ago, when the Memorandum of Understanding was signed, and it looked as if we had at least a temporary resolution of the crisis in the Persian Gulf and of the crisis in global energy markets, there was widespread commentary and discussion, which, by the way, at the time I said I thought was correct, that the apparent ending of the fighting in the Middle East and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz would first and foremost benefit Ukraine. It would benefit Ukraine because the price of oil would fall, which would obviously cause some problems for the Russians. But more importantly, it would mean that the United States, President Trump, had more time to think about other matters, specifically the issue of Ukraine, at a time when he appeared to be tilting more and more towards the Ukrainian side in the conflict. Now, of course, all that has gone up in smoke, so to speak. We are back where we were a few weeks ago. In fact, more properly, we're back where we were basically in March. The United States is again running down rapidly its inventories of advanced weapons. If you go to Sonar 21, you will find that Larry Johnson has again done a very detailed study of the state of US weapons inventories, of how Patriot missile interceptors, already in short supply before the US-Israeli attack on Iran on the 28th of February, how the inventory of these Patriot missiles has been reduced even further. This at a time when, by universal admission, Ukraine essentially has none left. That other types of missiles, the inventories of them, have also been reduced significantly, so that the Tomahawk missile inventory has also been severely reduced. Around 850 Tomahawk missiles were used over the course of March and early April in the fighting between Iran and the United States, as against a annual production of around 50 of these missiles. That the stockpile of JASSM's missiles, the air-launched stealthy cruise missile, of which at one time, by the way, there was a lot of discussion that it might be supplied to Ukraine, that the stockpile of these missiles has been reduced even further, again because of very, very heavy use of these missiles, so that there is now a shortage of these missiles as well, at a time when Zelensky and the Ukrainian government are short of pretty much everything except drones. But even there, as we will see, they're now running into problems. Well, at that point, when European production of weapons is still in its infancy, if it ever takes off at all, the United States is in no position to replenish the stockpiles of Ukraine. And I'm going to suggest that this plays a significant role in explaining the various moves that are being made in Kiev now to reshuffle the government. And there is a long article about this in the Financial Times, which vindicates the reporting of the website, the Substack site, Events in Ukraine, which to a certain extent I based my programme yesterday upon. The Financial Times confirms that Zelensky is indeed now moving to sack his defence minister, Mikhail Fyodorov. The title of the article in the Financial Times reads, Zelensky expected to remove Ukraine's popular defence minister, modernizer behind country's drone development at risk of being ousted in cabinet reshuffle after just 6 months in post. And then we go on to read, the president, Zelensky, is expected to remove defence minister Mikhail Fyodorov, the 35-year-old architect of Ukraine's wartime defense technology drive, after just 6 months in the post as part of a major cabinet reshuffle. We're told that Zelensky will complete the appointments to the new government by tomorrow. I said in my program yesterday that it seemed strange to me that he'd started the reshuffle before he left Kiev and went to France to attend the meeting of the Coalition of the Willing and to participate in the celebrations of Bastille Day in France, that he left, in effect, the entire cabinet hanging. Now he's coming back. He's going to complete the reshuffle. He's not, of course, providing any explanations for some of the moves that he's making, other than this is all partly intended to supposedly rejuvenate the government. But then we go on reading in the article comments like this from Sergei Fursa, a Ukrainian investment banker. He, that is to say Fedorov, made the mistake of becoming too popular. He also looks highly effective, and he does not tolerate corruption. All of which, by the way, I am going to argue, apart from his popularity, with certain people, is questionable. But then we also go on to read that Fedorov has also been in conflict for months with Ukraine's commander-in-chief, Alexander Sirsky. The dispute involved disagreements over how Ukraine should fight the war and organise its armed forces. And the president, that's to say Zelensky, was becoming tired of this. Arms procurement and military strategy were areas of disagreement, the people said. And then we go on to read that elsewhere in the article that the discussions about Fedorov's dismissal had become a major topic of discussion at the party held by the French embassy in Kiev on the 14th of July, yesterday in fact, in order to celebrate Bastille Day. Well, what of course this article does not acknowledge is that perhaps Fedorov is not quite as successful and as effective a defence minister as the Financial Times and his fans, his fan club in Ukraine and the US tech community would have us to believe. What he has basically done since he became defence minister is he has diverted very large amounts of funding to his friends in the drone sector in Ukraine. The result has been the production of a lot of drones. The drones have been launched against targets inside Russia. But it's clear that the ground forces, the conventional military, the people commanded by General Sirsky, have been feeling that they're becoming neglected and ignored because of all of this emphasis on drones, even as the actual situation on the battlefronts has gone from bad to worse. And unsurprisingly, it looks as if these people, the people in the military, and of course Sirsky as well, have been complaining about the situation increasingly to Zelensky and have been saying that this drone offensive that Fedorov has invested so much in and which has had the enthusiastic backing of the United States and of the Western media and of much of the commentariat has been a critical diversion of resources from the fronts which really matter. And that its actual effect is nowhere near as great than what the commentary about it might suggest. Now, this is a point I have been making for several weeks. I've had a great deal of pushback about it, but I think the evidence is starting to accumulate, essentially confirming that this is so. One sign that the drone offensive altogether is faltering is the recent developments that we are seeing. Ukraine has been conducting many long-range strikes inside Russia. I'll return to these in a moment. It's been trying to conduct strikes against Moscow, basically since the big strike against Moscow in early June. It's clear that the air defences around Moscow have now been ramped up and have become very effective. It looks as if the drones that Fedorov and his American and Ukrainian friends have been launching towards Moscow are not getting through. There has also been, of course, attacks on Russian refineries across Russia. But again, My sense is that the number of these strikes has started to dwindle, and that the fuel situation in Russia has indeed been easing over the last couple of days. And again, the effectiveness of these strikes on the refineries has been overstated. There's also, of course, been many strikes on Crimea and on Zaporozhye and Kherson region. But here also, we see the effect of the strikes beginning to fade. So, what has happened is that the Ukrainians, Fedorov and his backers, have been refocusing their drone offensive on the one target that they can reach and strike, and where they can produce real images that they can circulate in the media, by attacking civilian ships in the Sea of Azov. Now, over the last few hours, I've obtained a much clearer understanding of what has actually been taking place in the Sea of Azov. It appears that most of the ships that have been attacked were indeed freight ships, not tankers. Many of them do seem to have been carrying grain. Mostly, they were owned by private ship owners, and they were civilian vessels, not really or practically connected, or at least not directly connected, to the Russian war effort, by which I mean that they were not directly involved in providing logistics to the Russian military. And of course, attacking grain ships, which certainly a significant proportion of these ships, that is what they were, would be a controversial and unpopular move at any time, but perhaps especially now, when we have a global inflation crisis, which is probably going to create problems with food supply around the world, especially maybe in the global south. In fact, it's not difficult to understand what has been happening. The Ukrainians have been going from one target to another. First, they attacked the Novorossiya Highway for a couple of days, about a week, a bit more maybe than a week, maybe. They were able to produce lots of pictures of traffic on the Novorossiya Highway being attacked and disrupted, and for a time this became a big news story. Then the Russians took steps to protect the Novorossiya Highway. Then the attacks on Crimea itself and on Zaporozhye and Kherson region began, together with the attacks on the refineries. As the Novorossiya Highway became a harder target, in other words, Ukraine moved to softer targets. They also, at roughly this time, began to strike at Russian cities, at St. Petersburg and Moscow. And then, as all of these targets became harder to reach, as the Russian air defenses were strengthened, the focus shifted to the Sea of Azov. And in fact, as far as I can tell, over the last couple of days, it is the Sea of Azov that has been the main focus of Ukrainian attention. Now, attacks on shipping in the Sea of Azov are going to cause problems for the Russians, but as I've discussed in both of the two programs I have recently made, they're not going to be critically a critical problem, because the Russians, as they have said themselves, can transport grain and other goods from other ports across their enormous country with its gigantic coastline. This is not, for the Russians, a critical problem. Also, the Sea of Azov is a relatively confined body of water of finite size. At some point, the Russians are going to develop or install air defense systems that will successfully defend shipping in it. So this is, again, only a temporary operation. It can only work for a limited amount of time. So a drone offensive has been carried out. It has done some damage. It has forced the Russians to deploy air defenses in certain locations where perhaps previously they hadn't felt that they were needed. It has created some tension within Russian society, though the extent of that can be overstated. But it has not achieved the critical effects that its advocates, Fedorov first and foremost, suggested that it would. But it has amounted to a significant drain on Ukrainian resources as well. Now, in my program yesterday, I spoke about how the Russian counterintelligence agency, the FSB, was successfully rounding up and breaking Ukrainian cells of infiltrators who had entered Russia with drones and had been positioned around various strategic Russian facilities in order to conduct drone strikes against those facilities. There's been a whole cluster of operations which have cleared, which have ended up clearing these Ukrainian cells, suggesting that the Russians have now successfully penetrated either these cells or the Ukrainian intelligence system. I speculated that some of the deep strikes inside Russia, such as the attack on the Omsk refinery in Siberia, might have been conducted by drones that were operating from close proximity to the targets. In other words, from drones, Ukrainian drones, launched by these sabotage groups from inside Russia. I now understand that was wrong. And in fact, I understand that the attack on the Omsk refinery was indeed carried out by the big Ukrainian aircraft-type drones. Now, in a program that my colleague and friend Alex Christoforou did with him on the Duran whilst I was away in Montenegro, our friend Stanislav Krapivnik has provided a description of these airplane drones. And they are large, they're significant sized, they are relatively simple, but they do use aircraft engines, they do contain explosives, explosive warheads, they do have guidance systems. Some of them, Stanislav Krapivnik said, are about the size of a light Cessna aircraft. Now, that means that in terms of producing these drones, well, it would not be cheap and it would require a significant industrial effort. So this whole operation with the drones and with some launches of Ukraine's missiles, Flamingo missile, and those things, cannot have been without significant cost. One can in fact see that the expense of maintaining this drone offensive will have required large sums of money to be transferred to the Firepoint company in Ukraine, which is responsible for these drone strikes, and to the various partners and contractors scattered around Europe. Now, this brings me to a point that is often made by my colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, about the financial benefits that many people derive from this war. The fact that for them, the fact that they continue to receive large amounts of money to produce drones, to conduct strikes inside Russia, is a highly lucrative affair. And of course, they need to keep the funding going, which is one reason, of course, why they carry out strikes, which they can then sell to the media in the West and to potential donors as proof that the drone offensive is succeeding. And, well, we have seen lots of evidence of this. In fact, 2 days ago, I think it was, or maybe 3 days ago, a senior executive of the Firepoint company in Ukraine, which produces the drones and the missiles which are being used to conduct this offensive, he actually came out and said that Ukraine doesn't want or need a ceasefire. What it needs to do is to keep the war going all the time, because of course doing that enables Ukraine supposedly to upgrade its defense industries. In other words, to upgrade companies like Firepoint, which are the beneficiaries of most of these funds. It could not, in fact, be a more straightforward statement of the financial benefits of one of the reasons why the war is being sustained, at least on the part of some people in Ukraine, is because of the financial benefit that comes to them from doing so. And, well, that then brings us back to the drone offensive, because its purpose, it seems to me, is to keep money moving and going to particular people in Ukraine, those who are taking the credit for the drone offensive, more perhaps than to actually affect change on the battlefronts. And it is unsurprising, therefore, that some people in Ukraine, in the military in Ukraine, are becoming unhappy and are now complaining about this to Zelensky, with the result that Fedorov's job now looks to be very much on the line. We shall see whether Zelensky is able to act on these demands and to sack Fedorov. The fact that an article about him has appeared in the Financial Times shows that Fedorov still has his backers in the West. He's on very good terms with some of the big Western tech companies. There's a photo in the article of Fedorov with a baseball cap close to an executive, apparently from Palantir in the United States. I know nothing about this person, by the way, so I'm not going to comment more. But no doubt there will be people within the tech community in the United States who have been providing some of the technology and some of the drones, Hornet drones, for example, that had been used to attack the Novorossiya highway. And I'm guessing the ships in the Sea of Azov, they're not going to be happy, and they're going to try and push back, and they're going to try to stop Fedorov's sacking if they can. But then, from Zelensky's point of view, the fact that there are people in the United States who back Fedorov is probably a further reason to sack him. From Zelensky's perspective, he is altogether too close to the Americans. Anyway, we will see what happens. But this whole strange affair, again, I think demonstrates the extent to which this war is serving financial needs almost as much now as geopolitical ones, and the extent to which a lot of this war is being fought out in the media space rather than the battlefronts, and that the idea about the wars that we get on the media space are not necessarily accurate about what is actually going wrong. Now, on the last point, I'm going to express here something of my own frustration. The reason why we have heard so much about the drone offensive over the last few weeks is because the Ukrainians have been incessantly telling us about it, and because the media in the West has been writing about it. Now, these are the same people who are telling us that Konstantinovka is still under Ukrainian control. I mentioned 2 days ago that a whole article has appeared in the Financial Times which asserts that very thing. And again, the people who are telling us that Konstantinovka is still under Ukrainian control are the same people who are telling us about what a great success Ukraine's drone offensive has turned out to be. Since there is overwhelming evidence, I would say proof, that in fact Konstantinovka is actually under Russian control, why continue to believe people whose information has been consistently so unreliable? It baffles me. But anyway, there it is. Now, alongside all of the things that have been happening with the drone wars, it's perhaps important, though it's sometimes also very difficult, to keep track of what is actually happening in the battle itself. The Ukrainians, as I said, have been spending a lot of time launching drones, attacking ships in the Sea of Azov. By the way, I haven't yet seen conclusive confirmation about how many actual ships that the Ukrainian drones in the attacking ships in the Sea of Azov have actually sunk. I suspect it is very few. Just saying. But in the meantime, the Russians, as they promised, have been continuing to hammer at Ukrainian targets. They continue to destroy gas filling stations across eastern Ukraine. They continue to conduct strikes against military industrial facilities in Kiev and in the Kiev and Dnipro regions. And, of course, they have been conducting a relentless assault, the most powerful in the war so far, against Odessa and the port of Odessa. And every day I read about ships which have been trying to use to access the ports of Odessa. There's several of them, in fact. How these ships have been attacked and severely damaged by the Russians, and how ships that have tried to leave Odessa have been attacked as well, and how the various port facilities in Odessa have been hammered, and how the Russians are steadily demolishing the supply routes around Odessa. And of course, the Russians, because of the Ukrainian drone attacks on the civilian vessels in the Sea of Azov, are able to say that these are reprisal raids. And to some extent, perhaps that is indeed what they are. But I don't think that that is all that they are. They look to me, again, very much like the strikes on Kharkiv and Kiev also look to me. They look to me like softening up operations, preparations, early preparations, in other words, for the military operation to capture Odessa, which I am sure in time is going to come. And that there, such an operation is indeed, apparently, in course of preparation is, well, further suggested, and I stress it's only suggested because we don't know that this is necessarily true, but is reinforced by rumours that General Suravikin, the controversial but on the part of much of the army highly regarded commander, who for a few weeks in late 2022, early 2023, was the overall military commander of forces in Ukraine, Russian forces in Ukraine, and who is credited with the idea of creating the Suravikin line, the line of the massive line of defences which defeated Ukraine's offensive of the summer of 2023. Anyway, there are reports circulating that General Suravikin is coming back, that he's going to be put in charge of Russian forces in the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, that in other words, the two groups of forces in this area, one commanded by General Teplinsky, another commanded by an entirely different general, are going to be given unified command, and that the commander will be none other than General Suravikin, and that he's going to be given the job of capturing first Zaporozhye region and then of crossing the Dnieper and recapturing Kherson region and Kherson city, the city which he himself advised the Russian military back in the autumn of 2022 to abandon because it was too complex and too much of a diversion of resources to defend it. Anyway, Suravikin is going to be given the job of recapturing the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper, and then perhaps pressing on westwards towards Odessa itself. Now, these are rumours, and perhaps they are rumours being circulated by people who support Suravikin in Russia, who've never been happy with the way in which he was transferred from his posts in 2023 and basically sent to run things in Mali and West Africa, and who very, very much do want to see him back, and who believe that he is the correct, right commander for this sort of job. So it may be that there is no very great credence should be attached to these reports. And, well, for my part, I would say that Suravikin undoubtedly damaged his reputation, or did his reputation became damaged in 2023, because he was seen as getting altogether too close to Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner group, who, of course, as many remember, led, well, shall we call it, a mutiny against the Russian military leadership and attempted to advance on Moscow in what Vladimir Putin undoubtedly construed as an attempted coup. So Suravikin got caught up in all of that. I don't know whether he's been fully rehabilitated and forgiven, but certainly there are some military officers and some people in the military who would like to see him back. Certainly, my recollection of him is that he did prove a very forceful and charismatic commander. And if some kind of complex operation to cross the Dnieper, to capture Zaporozhye region and to cross the Dnieper and to capture Kherson city, recapture Kherson city, and then press on towards Odessa, if such a plan is really being prepared, well, I can see that some people might think that he is the right person to do it. But anyway, the fact, as I said, that this is being talked about does suggest that there is a lot of chatter and a lot of rumour about an offensive towards Odessa, ultimately towards Odessa. In my experience, when rumours of this kind circulate, they are usually true, just to say. And, well, the attacks on Odessa, on the areas around Odessa, do seem to me to be consistent, as I said, with preparations for precisely that kind of offensive. Whether Suravikin is going to lead it or not is, of course, an entirely different question. Well, anyway, that's one part of what's going on the front lines. Lots of other things are taking place in other places. I'm not going to do a full summary here. It seems to me that the chokehold, the tightening of the Russian noose around the Donbass cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk steadily increases day by day. And, well, it would be going too far to speak of a collapse of Ukrainian defences in Sumy and Kharkiv regions. But suffice to say that every day there, reports come through of the Russians capturing new positions and new settlements around the cities of Kharkiv and Sumy. And this, in conjunction with the further rumours about a big Russian offensive into neighbouring Chernihiv region from Bryansk region in Russia. Of course, an advance into Chernihiv region would bring the Russian army again within striking distance of Kiev itself, and that would almost certainly ring very loud alarm bells in Kiev and in the West too. Anyway, we shall see what happens in these places. For the record, in my opinion, the Russian objective to capture Kharkiv and Sumy, the cities, is becoming increasingly clear. And I've heard also that there is only one gas filling station left operating in Sumy, in the city of Sumy. I can't, of course, verify this, but I suspect it is true. And the destruction of all of these gas filling stations and the disruption of Ukrainian logistics inevitably at some point is going to have its effect on the development of the battle. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the situation on the battlefronts today. Now, I'm going to, having said all of this, now return to the situation in global energy and oil markets. We have again the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. There is at least a possibility that the Red Sea is also going to be closed, preventing entirely the export of Saudi oil, just to say. There are these reports that there's been attacks on the ports near the UAE that have been used by the UAE. And, well, it looks as if supplies of natural gas and of oil from the Persian Gulf are essentially going to stop. And this, even as the situation on global energy markets appears to be significantly deteriorating. There's been a very interesting bulletin about the situation in global energy markets from oilprice.com. They say, for example, this: LNG oversupply is expected to peak in 2031 to 2032, but the much anticipated 2026 LNG oversupply wave may not materialize. According to industry analysts, the oversupply in LNG in 2026 is not going to materialize. As the US-Iran conflict and recurring project delays impede commissioning, with Middle Eastern supply still capped, the blistering heat brought by this year's Super El Nino has pushed Asian LNG buying to its highest level in July, with imports set to reach 23 million tons. Asia and Europe are now competing for every available cargo, creating a zero-sum game for European buyers as Asia's benchmark JKM price jumped to $19.5 per presumably MMBTU on Tuesday, the highest since early June. Due to unfavorable economics, Europe has been getting the short end of the LNG stick so far, with Europe's imports poised to decline this month to 6.90 million tons, a two-year low, as European LNG prices trend consistently below the Asian benchmark, which is JKM. One of the most gas-deprived countries, Pakistan, has issued another tender to purchase prompt LNG for July delivery after Qatar's LNG exports were cut short by last week's attack on the AI Rekayat LNG carrier. And, well, what does that tell us? What it tells us is that even as we receive more and more reports that the situation with gas reserves in Europe is very poor, that European gas reserves, the amount of natural gas in the European reserves is lower than it's been for perhaps 10 years, perhaps further still. And with Europe increasingly rejecting imports of Russian energy, which are supposed to stop entirely in January, Europe is struggling to buy LNG to build up its reserves before the winter, because it cannot compete with the Asians, who are also buying LNG at record levels and who have deeper pockets. So European reserves of LNG are at low levels. Russian gas after January is no longer available. And the Europeans cannot compete with the Asians. Well, it doesn't look at all good. And apparently there's also been disputes about imports of gas from Algeria, which are further complicating the situation in Europe. Apparently this is mostly a German-Algerian quarrel, which I haven't followed properly. But overall, the situation with energy in Europe is not looking good at all. And that perhaps explains the rush to buy LNG from Russia before the curtain on buying energy products from Russia comes down in January. It seems that the last few weeks have seen record buying of LNG from Russia by European customers. Now, this has not been uncontroversial in Russia itself, but as I've discussed in previous programs, the Russians have a historic connection to Europe in terms of gas sales. They're still in the process of working out their contracts with the Asians, especially with the Chinese. And the Russians, understandably, the industry in Russia, understandably, wants to sell its LNG to a customer that's prepared to pay a good price. And for the moment, and most conveniently, that is Europe. But it is not going to be enough, and it is not going to be enough, certainly, to cover the shortfall in gas in Europe that is now building. And, of course, the United States also is a heavy user of gas, and US LNG companies can also, of course, sell their gas to Asian customers. There are no longer the long-term contracts for gas, because the European Union, incredibly, took the decision some years ago to buy gas mostly on the spot market. So everything points to a worsening situation with energy in Europe and very severe shortfalls in gas supply in Europe this winter. And if temperatures remain high in Europe this summer, then of course high temperatures themselves also lead to a heavy drawdown in gas, Factories and companies that still operate in Europe, admittedly, those now in increasing decline, but still there, they have to use more gas to maintain their systems during the hot weather periods. And though in Europe there is less use of air conditioning than there is in Asia and in the United States, for example, well, some people do use air conditioning and they're probably using it very heavily during this hot weather period as well. So it's looking unlikely that the Europeans are going to be able to replenish their stocks, their reserves. And winter is not that far away now. And, well, it's difficult to work out what in this situation the Europeans ultimately propose to do. Well, one thing they might do is close down even more of their factories. That, at least, is a way to save energy. It is a very destructive way to save energy because, of course, if you close down a factory, then there is no reason why necessarily it might reopen. But it is a way. And in fact, what we are seeing is that deindustrialization processes in Europe and especially in Germany continue and appear to be accelerating. So, over the last few days, there's been an announcement in Germany that Volkswagen, the biggest German car producing company, is now shedding 100,000 jobs. And this has created great anguish and bitter criticism in Germany. Criticism by unions and workers of Volkswagen management, though it seems to me that the criticism ought to be better addressed to Chancellor Merz and before him to Chancellor Scholz and, of course, to the Green ministers, Robert Habeck, the economics minister, and Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister, and all of these people who catapulted Germany into an economic war with Russia, which has increased energy costs multiple fold, and which has undermined the once famous competitiveness of German industry. And I noticed that in Germany, there are also inevitably now increasing criticisms of China, that China is supposedly dumping high value industrial goods in the German market, that the way the Chinese run their economy is creating an export machine. It's all very strange to me to read these criticisms coming from Germans about China, because just a few years ago, as I so well remember, the same criticisms used to be made by Europeans, especially Southern Europeans, about Germany, that Germany exploited an inbuilt competitive advantage, that it organized its economy around exports, that it was trading unfairly, and the Germans always used to come back indignantly whenever those criticisms were made about them, and they would say, not unreasonably, in fact, that they were being criticized for being too successful and too efficient. Well, now, of course, they find themselves in a different position. So they're making criticisms of China, which the Chinese also might respond to by saying that it is China this time, that is being criticised for being too successful and too efficient. Well, Volkswagen is going through these problems, and I ought to say that energy is not the only problem that the German car industry faces, and not just the German car industry, but the entire German industrial complex. I have been warning for years, at least 15 years, certainly throughout the Merkel era, going back, in fact, to the era of Helmut Kohl. I've been warning that Germany was coasting on legacy industries, that its investment rates were falling, that it was not innovating and was falling behind in technology and productivity terms, and that the economy was becoming old-fashioned and even outdated. Well, I was warning about all of that, but there is no doubt at all that the problems with energy have greatly compounded these difficulties. And if we do get a supply shock, an energy supply shock in the autumn, then of course all of these problems that I've just been talking about of the German industrial economy are going to start to get much worse. And they're going to start to get much worse at roughly the same time as we have important elections in certain German states, including, I believe, in Saxony, in the autumn. So, anyway, we shall see where all of this is going and whether things turn out as bad as they appear. Of course, I have been focusing in this program mostly on gas, but with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, it looks as if the problem is also going to be grave in terms of oil. But of course, it's not just oil and gas that are the problem, because we have had now a massive report in the Financial Times, China and the new era of critical minerals diplomacy. Beijing's export controls on rare earths and other niche metals are distorting markets and fueling resource nationalism. And, well, it's fascinating to read the article, but it talks about how there are growing shortages of certain minerals. We're told that yttrium is the killer choke point. We are facing an existential risk. As of yet, there is no date where we will have any fully de-risked supply chain. The limited supply, this is of yttrium, but it applies also to other rare earths, has caused panic, and that word is in the Financial Times article, in the past few months, says Nick Myers, chief executive of US rare earth startup Phoenix Tailings. Defense, automotive and semiconductor companies are calling all the time, with some warning that they may be forced to halt production by Christmas if they do not source the metal. This is yttrium. And we then read that even before Beijing's introduction of export controls, exports were warning that aging mines and soaring demand for the metals key to electrification, and AI might mean shortages. Now Western countries are feeling the effects of losing a metal processing industry they were happy to let move to China, a shock that has provoked market panic and a new resource nationalism. And then we learn a great deal, we read a great deal about the attempts to try to set up rare earth industries in the West in record times. And it turns out that it is far from being straightforward. The article says that China's control of metal supply chains is the result of three decades of investment and subsidies. It has backed the production of everything from copper used in cables and wiring to the battery metal lithium and a long tail of other metals, including rare earths and tungsten used in munitions. And the article actually does make a further and very important point, which is that one of the reasons why China has developed its rare earths technologies and other processing technologies to the level that it has done is because China is itself today the world's biggest manufacturer by far. It is therefore far and away the biggest market for rare earths and tungsten and copper and yttrium and all of these other metals that we hear so much about. And that is a limiting factor in developing rare earths industries, alternative industries in the West, because ultimately it might not be profitable to create these industries. The rare earths industries, the processing industries, are massively capital intensive and they're also heavily polluting. And given the withered state of Western manufacturing, there might simply not be a big enough market to make the production of rare earths in the West commercially profitable. Unless, of course, governments are prepared to subsidize it, which, however, would require a program extending forward for decades. Even if that happens, and I have to say the Financial Times article is not reassuring on this score at all, even if this happens, as the article itself admits, there is not going to be any significant reduction in China's overwhelming monopoly in terms of rare earths before 2030 at the earliest. We are probably more plausibly, and this is if everything is done properly in the West to try to reduce Western dependence on Chinese rare earths, we are likely to see actual changes in supply of rare earths, a diversification away from China in development and production of rare earths, no earlier, I would guess, than the early 2030s, sorry, than the late 2030s at best. Now, there are other things. It seems that the Chinese are indeed restricting exports of rare earths. They've not just stopped exporting them, but they're now creating a very, very sophisticated licensing system, which is creating all kinds of problems and issues. And, well, we're told metal flows have not ground to a total halt Instead, China has created a licensing scheme under which it decides who gets which minerals. The lengthy application process gives authorities, the Chinese authorities, detailed information about which metals overseas companies and their contractors are using and why. Applicants must show that the material is going into civilian rather than military supply chains. And companies, traders and analysts say material has been flowing, but at unpredictable paces, with license approval often slow. The export control system has evolved from a crisis into a managed system, though buyers still face compliance and commercial challenges. This embeds new uncertainty into corporate supply chains and risk customers switching to Chinese component suppliers whose metals purchases are not being monitored and squeezed. So, briefly, what the Financial Times is telling us in this article is that there is no short-term fix from a Western point of view to this problem of rare earths and of other critically short materials. It mentions elsewhere in the article, by the way, that there is hysteria as companies compete with each other to obtain access to limited stockpiles of substances like tungsten, that they're having to give the Chinese assurances that any rare earths that they do obtain are for civilian, not military purposes. That, of course, in turn means that the arms industries are seeing their supplies of rare earths choked away. Presumably, they are still producing weapons on the basis of historic legacy stockpiles, but these must be dwindling, and though they can take or obtain supplies of rare earths from civilian companies, the civilian companies must fear if they part with the rare earths that they have, that the Chinese authorities will find out about it and will choke off supplies of rare earths to them. And bizarrely and paradoxically, because the compliance issues that the Chinese are now insisting upon with rare earths are becoming so strict, Western manufacturers increasingly are choosing to buy from China the components, the manufactured industrial components, which contain the rare earths rather than the rare earths themselves, because that is cheaper and more efficient to do, thereby actually increasing dependency on China. Now, all of this is happening even as we have shortages of gas and shortages of oil. And I discussed in a recent program how the Chinese now also appear to be limiting or have blocked exports of helium. This is a burgeoning, festering crisis across the entire industrial supply chain. If there are going to be shortages of rare earths, then there will at some point inevitably have to be a reduction in production of weapons, or at least advanced weapons. I read in Larry Johnson's article on Sonar 21, his discussion about production of Tomahawk missiles, for example, and how these depend on rare earth components. And of course, the same is true of radar systems used by US fighter jets and all sorts of things of that kind. So we have these problems building up. We have energy shortages. We have shortages of rare earths. We have shortages of other critical materials like tungsten and potentially even copper. And, well, what we get instead is determination by the West to keep fighting in the Persian Gulf, to keep fighting the Russians in Ukraine, even as all of these shortages increase and mount. We are heading towards a dreadful reckoning, and that cannot be long delayed now. There might be some means, I'm not sure what they are, of getting through the energy problems in Europe and in the West over the autumn and the winter. Perhaps we will be lucky and the winter this year in Europe and in the Northern Hemisphere will be mild, just saying. But cumulatively, these problems are growing. Frankly, after reading this article in the Financial Times about rare earth shortages, I wonder how we can imagine that we can rearm effectively in Europe anymore, given the critical importance of rare earths in the military supply chains. And I spoke about drones and drone technology. And what do I read? We are now told, and this is also in the Financial Times, Ukraine to buy Chinese drone parts with EU funds. Brussels allowed Kiev to use part of a €6 billion euro tranche for items in short supply in Europe. And the Financial Times continues that this has exposed Europe's reliance on Beijing for critical parts as it struggles to build its own defence industries. And the decision underscores the gaps that remain in the EU's domestic defence production, despite a push to strengthen Europe's industrial base by tying aid for Ukraine to procurement in the continent. The carve-out also makes stark China's role in supplying both sides in the more than four-year conflict. And Ukraine itself has built one of Europe's most innovative defence industries under Russian bombardment, which, by the way, isn't true. Its domestic producers have outpaced traditional European arms companies in several areas, which isn't true either. However, its consumption of drones, which have become the dominant weapon on the battlefield, is still outstripping its capacity and that of its allies to produce certain components for the unmanned aircraft. Now, the Russians have been complaining to China for a long time that Ukrainian drones, the drones that have been used by Ukraine to attack targets inside Russia, are made out of Chinese components. Here we have an article in the Financial Times admitting as much. At some point, the Chinese will put a stop to this. And then, what does the West do? Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.